A serial killer and serial rapist named Legrel in France goes uncaptured by police for 35 years. 35 years of being able to prey on innocent people. When police decide to refocus their search, they call hundreds of people in for questioning and DNA testing because time's moved on and maybe, just maybe, they can find their killer. And when they do, well, let's just say something entirely unexpected is revealed. These are the crimes of the notorious Legrel. I'm Emma Kenny. Welcome to Bang to Rights, the deep dive crime podcast, which takes you through some of the most heinous crimes the world has ever seen. Now, the case I'm going to cover today is one that many of you probably haven't heard of, just because a lot of you watch from America and the UK and Australia and New Zealand, etc., Canada, and so on and so forth, and all different places in the world. And I'm sure that some of you do watch in France. What I'm saying is that a lot of people who aren't aware of French crimes won't have heard of this, and it is truly troubling and disturbing on every single level. I think that whatever is covered on my channel is always going to disturb us, but I always bring it down to the fact that when children are molested and murdered, it is just something that provokes something cerebral and visceral in all of us. It's just an uncanny yet true reality that these kind of crimes happen. But the hope is that when somebody carries out something as prolifically evil as this, they'll be caught. And they'll be caught quickly. Because for those individuals to be walking the streets, that's a threat to any child. And in fact, this case is more than just a child killer, and it is quite blindsiding when the reveal occurs, which I will do down the line, because it won't be the kind of person you expect at all to be responsible for these heinous crimes. So let's go back to the 7th of April, 1986. An 8-year-old girl basically goes into the lift of her apartment building, just going about her everyday business. She's going to go to school. So she needs to take the lift to make sure that she can go off on her journey to school. But that doesn't happen, because as she is leaving that very building, the place that's a sanctuary, the place that is safe, her home, the place where essentially she must feel safer than anywhere else in the world. And we all feel like that. We all relate to that. We all feel the sanctity of a home environment. But on this day, it's going to crumble for this child. A man forcibly grabs her. She's 8. He drags her to the basement of the apartment building, and then he does the most grotesque of things. He rapes her. He also, with respect at that point, doesn't just rape her and leave her. He tries to kill her. He puts a cord around her neck, tries to strangle her. And he believes that he has 100% successfully done that. He thinks he's murdered her. And then he leaves the scene at that point when he's satisfied, when he's got his evil way with this situation, and he's gone ahead and actually believed that he has choked the very life out of this beautiful little girl. Now, by the grace of God, she survives, and she's a bright cookie. She goes and speaks to the authorities. She's got a really good look at her attacker's face, because bear in mind, this man never imagined that she would be going to any authority, because he had her for dead for sure. So he had not considered that she might survive, so he hadn't covered his face. He didn't try to disguise himself in any way. So she notices that one of the standout features of this attacker is he's got a heavily pockmarked face. So essentially, he's had teenage acne and it's left pockmarks in the face. She tells the police this. She gives a good description of him. But they actually come up with no leads. They actually have no evidence. And that means that the attacker is unable to be found. And it's quite shocking that there's no leads and no evidence when you consider the fact that he walked into an apartment building that won't not have been frequented by other people. He was able to drag this child down to the basement, which would suggest that potentially he'd scoped the area out and he knew the actual apartment block and where he could carry out such a heinous crime and be undiscovered. And yet nobody's seen anything. Or maybe the way that they actually dealt with the crime scene meant that they did it poorly and nothing was brought up. I appreciate that at this moment in time, the year that we're talking about, DNA analysis is certainly not where it is today. And arguably, some would say that policing and investigations are not as they are today. There is a great deal more diligence around crime scenes than there were back then. But nonetheless, it feels strange to imagine that there is not a jot of evidence that is found by the police. Now, on the 5th of May, 1986, 11-year-old Cecile Bloch. She gets reported missing. She hadn't shown up to school in Paris. This was totally out of character. Immediately, alarm bells ring. It turns out that that poor child, 11, she's been snatched. Just like that other child had been in her apartment block, she too was snatched. She's leaving her apartment building. This is in the 19th district of Northern Paris. She was like the other child on her way to school. At this point, she's taken in the elevator and she's forced into the apartment building's basement in an exact replication of the crime that I talked about shortly before this. She gets raped. She gets strangled. But then this time he assures himself that she isn't going to be able to speak to the authorities because he stabs her in the chest. An 11-year-old little girl brutalized and executed in this horrendous way. What kind of human being can do this? Investigators actually discovered that there were two traces of strangulation, so two different forms of strangulation, and there were also abdominal stab wounds just under her heart. And let me tell you, this attack was so brutal, so grotesque, so aggressive, so terrifying, so chilling for this child, that when he stabbed her, it was with such force that it literally broke her spine. That's how she died. Her body was then discovered in the basement of the building, to the horror of those who found her. And it was her mother that had actually contacted the building's patrolman because she'd been told Cecile hadn't made it to school. And he then scoured the building looking for this missing child, undoubtedly hoping that she was hiding or that she was having fun with friends and just hadn't turned up to school. Or at worst, thinking that maybe she'd had some kind of accident and was incapacitated and he could help. But that didn't happen. Instead, he found the gruesome discovery of Cecile's brutalized naked body. She'd been covered by an old carpet, and cords were actually also found at the crime scene that they realized was probably used to strangle her and also tie her up. You can imagine that the residents of that building were absolutely horrified, petrified. There is a child that's been murdered in the most horrific of fashions. And they start to rack their brains. Did we see anybody? Was there anybody that stood out that shouldn't have been in our apartment building? And many of them recall that they'd actually seen a man in the elevator. And one of the things that stood out was he had this pockmarked, acne-scarred skin. They didn't know him. He wasn't somebody that they recalled was a regular visitor. He wasn't living there, and nobody felt that he related to them, so there was no reason for him to be there. And interestingly and sadly enough, Cecile's older half-brother, so the victim's older half-brother, said that he actually had this memory of interacting with this specific man. He said he seemed so sure of himself. He said he spoke to me in this very bold, very polite way too. He said something to me like, have a very, very good day, which is unbelievably sinister when you think of the backdrop of the story that I'm discussing, that this man confidently strode in to an apartment block knowing that his intention was to rape and kill a child. And he can just have general conversations with people in a rather charming way, maybe overconfident, maybe superior, as we would expect for the mindset of somebody who does these kind of crimes. But certainly interactions, even with the victim's half-brother, bold. And the very fact that he carries out the crime in such a bold way, and that bold behaviour, that overconfident behaviour, demonstrates that interplay that crucially we see in individuals who have psychopathic intentions. You know, they're very good at wearing a mask of suitability, a mask of acceptability, a mask of pleasantness that hides the monster beneath. And there is nothing more monstrous than I've just described. So Cecile's half-brother then helps the police to draw a sketch of the suspect. And that sketch is released in 1986. It shows a man of around 25 years old. They said he was around 6 feet tall. He had light brown hair and he had those visible traces of acne on his face. Now this crime, of course, was almost identical to the first, except that he'd finally killed the victim successfully. It does obviously seem that he changed his methods slightly because he stabbed this child as well. He wanted to be absolutely assured. The fact that he stabbed her, as far as he would have been concerned, in the heart, yes, it broke her spine and yes, it finally killed her. But the point is, that was why he was aiming for such a vital area of her body. He didn't want her speaking to anybody. France was stunned. literally Cecile's murder blindsided the whole country. The suspect at this point, who is harrowing as far as people in the local community and wider community is concerned, is given the nickname by the French press, Le Grel, which means the pockmarked man. And the murder of Cecile Bloch was basically Le Grel's most notorious case. But again, there was no other evidence, there were no other leads, and the police failed to find a killer, which is truly devastating because we have parents who have got one child who has been brutalised and raped and all but killed, and another that's been successfully murdered in an all but copycat killing, and still, there's apparently no evidence. They're not finding this monster who's walking the French streets. Now, it turns out that this exact killer was also responsible for the murders on the 28th of April, 1987, of 38-year-old aviation technician Gilles Politi. Now, it also turns out that this ruthless killer and prolific killer now was also responsible for the murders on the 28th of April, 1987, of 38-year-old aviation technician Gilles Politi, and also the au pair that was employed by the Politi family. So she was there, because she's basically there to look after the children. She was 21. 21 years of age, a girl called Irmgard Müller. They were literally savagely tortured before they were finally murdered. And this is an escalation, an amplification of the behaviours of this killer. This killer is certainly the same killer as the two girls. But now he isn't just satisfied with raping and murdering a child and doing it in a brutalized and torturous fashion. He needs more. He needs to additionalize to the killings. That's how he's going to titillate himself, thrill himself. He's growing in his aggression, in his rage, in his anger. And it's not enough to carry out crimes as I've just described in the first and second instance. No, now he wants to take more time. And it turns out that those two individuals were savagely tortured before they were finally killed. This is in an apartment again in Paris. And this is, I would say, therefore, a different victim profile to his first attack, clearly because it's adults, for a start, but also the way that he kills them. Now, the bodies of these two were discovered in the apartment building. This is, by the way, a really affluent neighbourhood of Marais in Paris. And it was the Politi's family apartment, which was understandably a residence that was very lovely and should have been ultimately safe because it is in such a lovely area. And as I said, Gilles Politi and the family au pair, Irmgard Müller, are both there going about their business, having no idea that they are literally going to have their lives ended within hours of that particular waking up on that day that would have felt totally ordinary, extraordinarily ordinary. That's what life is like, isn't it? We accept our day-to-day security without realizing how extraordinarily lucky we are. And we accept that. We have that myth of security, that bias of security. We think that we can go about our business, it will all be all right. And it is so shocking when these kind of things change everything about the world that we've known and inhabited. And in this case, the world that will end because this individual has chosen this particular day to execute you. And you have no idea when you wake in that morning or you take your first sip of coffee that this is actually going to happen to you. And it was horrific. So during the attack, Politi had been stripped naked. He was forced to lie down. His arms were basically tied behind his back. His feet were tied behind his back. And he was bound in basically a choke lace. He was 100% incapacitated. He had no power. He was completely restrained. He couldn't see what was going to happen. He didn't know what was going to happen next. Now, if you are a torturous killer, you're going to love that. It reminds me to some degree of BTK, Dennis Rader, in the fact that he liked to take time. It wasn't enough for him to just murder his victims. We're not talking about a disorganized killer like Richard Chase, for example, who comes into a home, mass kills the people in it by shooting and then takes time with their bodies afterwards. He's disinterested in the torture. That doesn't give him any kicks. It's more the BTK, the organized type of killer, somebody who knows that they want to elongate as much time and suffering to play out their grotesque fantasies. And like I said, this killer is growing in his antagonism, growing in his resentment, growing in his rage, growing his enjoyment. And by tying this poor man down in this way, he's ripped away from him his masculinity. He's preventing him from being protective of himself and of anybody else. And that's alluring. to these power-hungry individuals, these individuals with these omnipotence complexes where they just want to feel like God. Politi, aside from being tied in this absolutely humiliating way, is then tortured. He's got cigarette burns all over his body. And you can imagine how long a cigarette burn takes to actually induce marks. You know, you're putting it into the skin and you're burning it, and you're doing that on multiple occasions. And that means the person doing it is casually smoking cigarettes as he's inflicting this clear agony. Irmgard Muller, she's been hung by her arms from the upright frame of a bunk bed. And of course, she's completely immobile. And she's no match for a man anyway, physically. She's a slight young woman. And therefore, she's just going to be in a position where she can be overpowered by this killer and too terrified potentially to even fight back. Maybe even promise that if they just go ahead and do what he says, nothing bad will happen. We've seen time and time again how murderers use these kind of ruses to incapacitate their victims and render them helpless. She, again, is tortured. She's got cigarette burns all over her. She's then tormented with a knife. And after he's had his fun, after he's gone ahead and carried out this harrowing, terrifying attack on these two people who just were going about their day without any clue of how it was going to end for them on a final level, the final indignity occurs and he just slashes their throat with a knife. And there's two of them. And I always feel that additional burden of horror for these individuals when you know that one of them would have been aware of the other one having their throat slashed and having to potentially hear the cries and the chokes and the gurgling and then know that that killer is coming for them next. I do not know how psychologically traumatizing that could possibly be. It just provokes something in me that makes me feel like it would be the most horrifying ordeal that anyone can end their days on this earth experiencing. Now, one of the things that the police said when they looked at this case was, bear in mind, it is very distinct from the first two that I've talked about. They said that it felt personal because they had this sick torture element. They'd been forced to endure something that the killer had obviously really enjoyed, but that basically felt so intimate, like they were enjoying making both of those individuals feel so helpless and powerless. And possibly, therefore, there was a projection of anger towards the both of them. But I would say that's a misstep because we often see in crimes of passion and personal attacks that people will use overkill. That goes without saying. So when you find people who've got real grudges about individuals, or even in situations where stalkers who believe they have some kind of weird relationship with somebody that actually has no relationship with them whatsoever, or stalkers who've been in relationships with people, it's ended and they just haven't been able to let go of that, you will find that when they stab those victims, for example, they might stab them 30, 40, 50, 60, 70 times, and you can feel that they're actually allowing the venting of all of that anger and rage and frustration and abandonment and all of that false feeling that they believe they're entitled to. They take it out on the individual that they know. But we don't often see people using a cigarette in crimes of passion in situations where there's a personal basis to that feeling. This feels more of that protracted serial killer attack. You know, somebody who's really getting the gain from seeing the horror on the individual's faces, probably provoked further from the fact that they don't have a clue who this person is, who's broken in and is now killing them. So the police connect with this idea. Yes, maybe this is something to do with somebody looking in from the outside who knows one or both of these people. And the likelihood is it could be somebody who's really romantically involved with Irmgard Muller, that this is a man. This is the person who's probably feeling concerned about the relationship maybe she has with Gilles, but this is wrong. But nonetheless, the reason that they come to that conclusion initially is because the killer apparently has been let into the apartment without question. And there are witnesses in this situation. They'd seen a man entering the apartment. He'd actually been speaking to Irmgard through the apartment on the intercom. This is on the day prior and on the day of the killing. So this guy's been seen twice. But think about an organized serial killer. Think about an individual who likes playing the game. Because part of being an organized, in particularly an organized serial killer, or even one that cross-sections organized to disorganized, but those who are consciously aware of what they want to do, why they want to do it, those who enjoy the game, those who live in a fantasy state for a long period of time, They essentially go out of their way to create these fantastical ideas in their mind about how they're going to carry out the perfect crimes. And the planning and plotting of that is powerful. One of the things that we see that they'll often do is they'll literally lock in on victims. They'll home in on them. Now, we know this individual has a particular connection with apartments. So that's really, up until this point, his stalking ground. He likes an apartment. Now, we have to appreciate in this area of Paris, there are a lot of apartments, but he obviously has a confidence about going to these places. Maybe it's because there's hustle and bustle, there's lots of different people. He feels that he'll be more anonymous in those circumstances. Maybe it's because he likes the thrill of just having an option to choose anybody and everybody in those places. Maybe it's because he enjoys scoping out those places and positions and figuring out the kind of victim he's going to go for and then locking in. And we see organized killers doing this. The fact that he's been seen there the day before, the fact that potentially he's had contact with Irmgard the day before as well, that suggests a man who is enjoying the chase. He's a predator who is planning and plotting and is getting ready to carry out the unspeakable while appearing to all intents and purposes like a normal human being. That may have been able to create a ruse where Irmgard is going to let him in to the apartment. And let me tell you, as much as so many of us can sit there and believe that we would never be the kind of person that would open our doors to a stranger, we do it all the time. Very few people, when somebody turns up, for example, with a gas man badge and says, I need to check something because apparently there's a leak on your road. Very few of us are like, let me just ring your employers. Let me just check things out. A lot of us are just like, okay. All you have to create as a killer is a sense of urgency so that somebody allows you into their home, or indeed a ruse to get in there because you're saying that you need information off them or something's happened that's led you to have to come to their place to get some information. And very often we will open our doors to people because we genuinely think that we can trust the world, and on the whole, we can. And they use that against us. It's as simple as that. That's why we have chinks in our armor, because we dare to believe the world around us is safe, because most of the time it feels it. But they just need one moment of weakness, as far as they're concerned, in us. And that allows the wolf right through the door. Again, and I don't know how, there's no leads, there's no evidence apparently. So the attacker once again evades arrest. Now, this killer's also been attributed to the 1994 murder of 19-year-old Karine Leroy in Meaux. That was on the 12th of June, 1994. She was actually found dead on the edge of a wood. She disappeared again when she was on her way to school. And the reason this attack was linked with Legrell is because the state of her body and how it was found. So Karine was lay on her back. There was this plastic string laced around her neck. It had been twisted with a stick behind her back. That's known as the Spanish tourniquet. So that particular technique that had been reflected in the murders of Irmgard Müller and Giles Politi. So essentially they were like, this feels very, very similar. And it's a very specific way of killing. And we know that certain serial killers have a particular MO and signature, and they felt that these were very relatable. Also, the age of this child and the fact that she's found in this manner certainly suggests that, yes, she was not in an apartment, but nonetheless, she was found killed in a way that's very resonant of prior murders. Also, we have to remember that whilst most organised killers will actually figure out a plan to execute that plan, the truth is that they also have impulses and compulsions based on the way that they feel that day. So for the most part, they can contain themselves and they spend a lot of time planning and thinking about consequences because they want to get away with it. They want to repeat their offences. That's a big part of being organised. However, just like, shall we say, with Israel Keyes, he's an individual who went out of his way to be highly organised. I would say probably one of the most organised serial killers of modern time, maybe ever. And even he couldn't deal with those compulsions at one point, and that's what tripped himself up. If you haven't seen my Israel Keyes video, I strongly suggest you should, because it is one of those that really is blindsiding and harrowing in equal measure. What I am saying is, it doesn't matter how arrogant they are, how superior they are, how much they believe that they can control their impulses, at points they can't. So opportunism can play into it, and that particular murder I've just talked about, where she's found on the edge of the woods and not in an apartment or a basement or hidden, that could demonstrate demonstrate that what happened in that moment was he took an option because she wasn't around anybody, there weren't witnesses, and he just couldn't control the impulse to want to kill. Now, a whole decade after Cecile's murder, we've got genetic testing. And it is incredible how genetic testing has completely changed the landscape of investigations and also brought to justice very quickly people who kill today, and also open cold cases which have finally led to perpetrators who have been walking our streets free, thinking they've got away with murder, to justice finally. There is nothing more soothing and satisfying for me when these arrogant killers finally get caught and they genuinely thought that they would never serve a day in prison and they spend the rest of their miserable days. That for me is a beautiful thing, and I know that every single one of you watching this will share it. So now they start doing the genetic testing on evidence that has been kept, you know, things that didn't seem necessarily like they could get anything from back in the day, but now because of these amazing leaps and bounds in scientific and genetic research, they can do testing that can shed new light on old cases. And that genetic testing literally reveals that the killer had gone on to rape at least six women between 1986 and 1994. Now, in three separate rapes, he actually identified himself as a policeman. Yeah, he told his victims he was a policeman. Now, he did this to a 26-year-old German woman. Then in October 1987, he did it to a 14-year-old girl. She was basically just going home from school. She gets stopped by this man. He says he's a police officer. And of course, he says he needs to question her for an investigation. Now, just psychologically place yourself in the position of a 14-year-old girl walking home from school. A man approaches you, says, I'm a police officer, maybe presents as a police officer, and then says, you need to come with me. I need you to answer some questions. What 14-year-old, there will be some, don't get me wrong, there will be some who'd be like, jog on, mate. I'm going nowhere with you. You'll have to come home and see my mum and then we'll take it from there. I've done nothing wrong. There will be some of you listening now will be like, I'd be that kid. Maybe I'd have been that kid. I was pretty angsty when I was young. But what we know from psychological studies, and many, is that the vast majority of young people feel in that moment they have to behave, they have to do what they're being told. And the reason for that is from day dots, from going to school onwards, you pretty much reinforce constantly, be nice to people in authoritative positions, respect your elders. The mantra exists, be a good human being, comply. And even though that is something that can cause us the greatest distress and in fact lead to our deaths in certain situations, many of us still feel that we have to go along with it. So she goes along thinking she doesn't have an option. And at that point, she gets dragged into an apartment. He handcuffs her, he rapes her, he then burgles the apartment. He does leave her alive, thank God, but she's traumatized clearly by this horrific event. Then in June 1994, an 11-year-old girl, 11, she's identified as Ingrid. She gets approached by a man again, says he's a police officer. He abducts her. He then drives this terrified 11-year-old little girl more than an hour away, takes her to this abandoned farm in Essonne, and here she is raped for several hours, which is just impossible to conceive of. She's 11, and she's being forced into this protracted agony as her naivety and childhood innocence is absolutely denigrated. It's disgusting. Now, he leaves the scene without killing her, thank God, but nonetheless, it demonstrates the true gravity of this monster. Now, at the time, investigators said to themselves, this guy's good, you know? He's come up with the perfect ruse. He's come up with the perfect manipulation. He's going up to these kids and young people and saying, I'm a policeman. And that means that they're on the back foot. They feel like they've got to comply. They're going ahead. They don't want to get into trouble with authority. So he's basically using the police officer mode as a disguise. Now, absolutely understandably, the Le Grail murders and rapes shocked Paris to the core. They were happening between 1986 and all the way till 1994, and no one got caught. They knew that one person was responsible for them. They had the genetic evidence that long last that was the case, but he never got identified. It's uncanny to imagine that someone can get away with these kind of crimes that are so prolific and so protracted and involving so many victims and still walk the streets. And we're talking for 35 more years. No one knows who this man is. He's free to roam. He's free to kill. He's free to rape. Because let's be honest, serial killers and serial rapists, they don't have to stay in one place. You could easily leave Paris and go somewhere else. You could easily continue your rampage that you're confident at. You have an MO and signature that now gives you more confidence. You've already got the arrogance. We've seen that from the people who interacted with him. He was bold. He was somebody who knew what he was doing. He had organized tactics and he got away with murder. So why wouldn't he continue to get away with murder? Now, the killer was actually said to have used a police identity card and handcuffs to abduct and restrain the victims that I've just described. Also, it was noted that during the actual crime, he used very elaborate police and military restraint tactics. So the attacks demonstrated that he had some kind of insider knowledge. Now, eventually down the line, a long way down the line, officers uncover evidence that LeGrail was actually a member of the security force who'd been driving a white car. So as opposed to this man, just shall we say, wearing a mask of being a policeman, it turns out that there's something a little bit more deeply connected to the authorities than just a random person pretending that he was a police officer. Also, his last known crime had reportedly happened near a gendarmerie training centre. So now there's a link which feels a little bit too connected, a little bit too synchronised, a little bit too coincidental to throw out the idea that this isn't simply somebody pretending to be a police officer. This isn't somebody who may be using this as a ruse. This could actually be somebody who'd been in the peacekeeping and protective forces. Now, in 2021, so we're talking about right up and to modern day, cold case investigators start to manage to narrow the search to former gendarmes. So they're the French paramilitary police officers. Then they start the process of summoning hundreds of them for questioning. Think about that. Think about being somebody who's walked our streets for 35 years, who's had decades to continue killing and raping, or getting on with their life in different ways, all the while knowing what they've done, all the while potentially working in a field where they're watching DNA, scientific breakthroughs, the evolution of new techniques, and realizing that every single day, the net is closing in. No matter how arrogant, superior, bold you are as a human being, that's going to play on your mind without a doubt. You're going to have considered the reality that one day, that knock on the door may just come. And all of a sudden, that knock on the door finally arrives in 2021. Imagine how that would feel for a killer who genuinely believed, because they'd been free for so long, that they had committed the perfect murder, only to realize that simply waiting in the wings was justice. And yeah, it was gonna take time. And yeah, for some of the victims' families who would die because they were older and never got to see justice for their children, etc., that's too late. But nonetheless, imagine the impact of that knock on the door. On the 29th of September, 2021, all is revealed. On the 29th of September, 2021, the body of 59-year-old retired police officer François Varove was discovered. It was discovered in a rental apartment in Grau-de-Rai. He had died by suicide. He'd actually ingested a large dose of medication. Of course he had, because he was a coward. Let's be real about this. Before I talk further about his motivations, his suggestions for why he took his life, let's be real. A narcissistic psychopath does not like people controlling who they are, and what they do, and where they're going to live, and where they're going to be for the rest of their lives. It's not on their cards. The idea of being hauled in front of the courts, family finding out about what he did after he's managed to hide under the radar and work in such an apparently authoritative and respectful position, that's not something he's going to want played out in the public, in the press. He knows the story. He's been in the police force, so he's an individual who's aware of the impact of the reveal of LeGrail will have. He's not going to want to be part of that. So he takes the easy way out. He takes his life. It's as simple as that. Now, in his suicide note, He is said to have confessed to a series of murders and rapes, and he admitted that he was indeed Legrelle. French media blew up at this point. They couldn't believe it because this man was one of their own. He was one of the good guys. And yet he'd been using that persona to rape and kill children and others as well as children. He was the face of acceptability and respectability, all the while being as far from that as possible. French media reported that in his note, Verhoeven said that the reason that he'd gone ahead and killed these children, raped these children, murdered these innocent individuals was because he had not been in a, quote, good state at the time of the crimes, but had later, quote, sorted himself out. Could you be any more warped? Just like consider that statement. So he's basically saying to you, you know what? Yeah, I raped and murdered children in the most torturous and brutal of fashions. Yeah, I killed these innocent adults in the most torturous of ways. But at the end of the day, I was just having a bad time. I was having a bad time. It was just one of those things that happened. And then I decided, you know, I'm quite a good person. I don't have to do this anymore. And so, like, just accept that I was having a bad day. I mean, you know, I don't know about you guys, but if I'm not out there serial killing because I'm having a stressful time and you can't see it in your heart to just accept it's a completely acceptable reaction. You know, you're going to work, your manager has a word with you, you don't agree with them, it stresses you out. So you wait till the end of the day and then you kill them, put the body in a boot, take them to the landscape, burn them and bury them. If you're not doing that regularly because you're a little bit stressed, what are you doing? It's ludicrous. He sorted himself out. And he even goes as far as to say that he acted on impulses caused by a difficult childhood. Now, I get it. A lot of you will be saying, when it comes down to the childhood of serial killers, there's a lot of trauma. Yes, there is. A lot of trauma in a lot of people's lives. It's a lot of trauma in a lot of people's childhoods. In fact, if we were to just talk about sexual abuse, the belief is that one in six children in Western environments will have been sexually molested either directly or vicariously online by the age of 16. So that's a lot of people. And that's before we talk about neglect, before we talk about physical, emotional abuse. These are all big players in childhood. Sadly, even though there are great parents out there, there are a lot of not great people out there as well. And the truth is that if trauma led you to serially kill, well, there wouldn't be a lot of humans left, would there? So using childhood as an excuse is ludicrous. And also, when you look at the key research, the vast majority, and I mean the vast, vast, vast majority of individuals who have been harmed as children become good human beings who would never raise a hand to anybody else. It's as simple as that. But yeah, he had a difficult childhood. So you know how he handled it? He went and raped and murdered children. So his difficult childhood, he reckons, is a reason to actually eradicate other children from the planet in the most brutal of fashions. Makes no sense. Doesn't make any sense on a psychological level at all. Like I said, if you've experienced and endured horror as a child, and we're looking at a psychological reasoning as to why you then manifest to kill, you would not imagine killing children. Because killing children would be a direct representation of you as a child. And therefore, your desire would be to protect the child because, hey, they're innocent. You might well feel a rage towards people who replicate a level of abuse towards you when you're an adult, or indeed represent a projection of who you experienced and endured abuse from as a child. We can acknowledge that could be a possibility. It wouldn't excuse it, but at least there would be some kind of logic. But no. This man, who's clearly a child molester and paedophile and murderer, he wants to paint himself as somebody who just had a bit of a bad time. And so, you know, he did the obvious. He murdered innocent people, including children. He also said that he had carried, quote, a mad rage that made me a criminal. Well, again, a mad rage doesn't make you a criminal. We've all had very challenging feelings. And the truth is, we can go and do a range of things about those mad, rageful feelings, like call a friend and suggest that that evening you are going to come over with two bottles of wine and moan and vent. That's one explanation. Another one is go to therapy. have a chat with a professional because you've got this mad rage. Another one is to, I don't know, try a bit of mindfulness, yoga, meditation. I don't know, go for a run. Hell, there's quite a lot of solutions and suggestions to deal with the mad rage other than carry out these brutal attacks. He also said, there were times when I couldn't stand it, the mad rage he's referring to, and I had to destroy, sully, kill someone innocent. Again, as if these are excuses, as if these are reasons for the actions I've described. The killing of innocents. And his rage didn't make him think, I'm so angry, I need to kill. Maybe I should go and find some really bad people. I'm not suggesting, by the way, it's ever okay to just go and kill bad people. I'm saying that on a range of, if we're dealing with a mad rage that's about being horribly treated, probably the last people you would want to treat badly are the most innocent and vulnerable people in the world, which are kids. So if he had that mad rage and he can identify it and recognize it, and also he can analyze it to some degree as he's trying to in this suicide note, he could have tried to actually harm people who, shall we say, were more deserving of negative outcomes than kids. He went on to say that his demons were appeased by his marriage and the birth of his children, and he took charge and did nothing since 1997. Now, again, this is not unusual. Serial killers don't always carry on killing. It's one of the myths that serial killers always continue killing. Some of them stop. And there are reasons for why some of them stop. They get old. They get bored because age changes them. Hormones change them. They get to 60 and they've not got the energy anymore. They get sick. They get ill and incarcerated for other crimes. Or they have life transitions and they end up in situations where they're busy and they've got a different focus for their energy. And because you meet people who love you and accept you, even when you are a serial killer, even when you're a psychopathic murderer, the truth is that it can alter the way that you feel about your world. And you only have to alter something slightly to have different outcomes. It wouldn't make him a good person, but it could mean that the desire to actually kill is subdued, at least for a period of time, even decades. By the way, it doesn't mean that he wouldn't kill again. And I think that's really powerfully important to state. This guy's only in his 50s at this point. If his wife had left him, if something terrible had happened to one of his children, if he'd lost his jobs, etc., anything that can increase stress could have returned him to a state of killing. So what we're seeing here is a transitional period in his life where he has other things to do, and that is not uncommon where serial killers are concerned. And he said that he wanted to take his own life to basically protect his family from the blowback surrounding his crimes. BS. Massive amount. Can somebody bring the... Bring in the BS detector. Oh, we've got a big BS light detector as well. So we've got the smell detector, the light detector. Oh, we've got the specialised dog detector. Yes, just, oh, what are they doing? They're finding a massive amount of BS right now. He is not taking his own life to protect his family. He is not doing this for any other reason that he knows damn sure he's caught. Damn sure people are going to realise who he really is. And he doesn't want to be there to see it. He doesn't want to be able to witness his poor wife and children dissolve as they realize they have been married and fathered by a monster. She's been sharing a bed with a rapist and child killer. Like, no woman wants to wake up with that on her conscience. No child wants to think about all the memories that they had with the father that they loved and have them sullied by the reality that's coming. And he knows that. He's not protecting anyone apart from himself. Also, I would say that the suicide note is very narcissistic. It's all about him. It's all about apparently being a good person who now has been decent in his life and loved his family and is protecting his family. There's no mention of the details of the crimes or the victims, the names or the places or the circumstances. You know, he's not interested in any of the families having some kind of closure. It's just all about him. And he ended the note saying, I admit to being a serious criminal who committed unforgivable acts until the end of the 1990s. Can you hear that? So even when he's taking responsibility and accountability for these crimes, he's doing it in a psychologically disassociative position. He's saying, yes, I was a serious criminal, you know, until the end of the 1990s. That's what he's saying. He's saying, yeah, that old me, yeah, that was unforgivable. But the new me, well, I was an all-round good guy. That's his mindset. So he's not taking accountability and responsibility at all. And like I said, the egocentricity, by neglecting to mention the victims, by neglecting to talk about the actual crimes in detail so that people can have an understanding and closure, that demonstrates the level of nonchalance and the level of disassociation he has to actually what he did. And I'm sure that as he descended into a stupor, as he overdosed on the drugs, that he was very quickly bundled into the elevator and taken directly to Beelzebub, where he now burns brightly under his own personal BS detector that's burning at, I don't know, 3 million degrees Fahrenheit for eternity. That's what I imagine is happening to him right now. Probably occasionally visiting from heaven are the children that he did diabolical things to and the victims he did diabolical things to. And I don't know, they're given an opportunity to poke and stoke the fire. Maybe with a sharp stokey pokey object that at times isn't just used for the fire. Verove was actually one of 750 gendarmes. So again, the French paramilitary police officers, that's what the gendarmes are. They were summoned to the police because they suspected that they worked in security services. It turned out that he'd been a gendarme between 1963 and 1988. Then he'd become an actual police officer. And then he'd retired and ended up working for the local council in the south of France. Shocking beyond belief. I mean, this is the kind of chameleon that we expect in these cases. Could you be any more masked than being a gendarme, police officer, working for the local council? Smells a little bit of Dennis Nielsen, doesn't it, that? The serial killer, just embodied and embedded within the local community. Now, during his time in the police force, it turned out he was briefly suspended. He'd had an incident with a prostitute, but he was actually allowed to rejoin the force shortly after by senior officers. So I imagine that back then, it was all the boys together, wasn't it? Oh, there's just been an incident with a sex worker. Not described what the incident is because I couldn't find it, but I doubt if it led to your suspension, it was something positive. But hey, who hasn't had an incident with a sex worker, I imagine was the mindset of the police in that time. I would question his credibility if he did anything untoward. When it comes down to it, he shouldn't have been allowed back in the force, but he was. Now, Verove had actually been sent a summons on the 24th of September, and he was to be called in for questioning for the 29th of September. So on the 27th of September, Verove's wife was very upset. She was worried about him. He'd gone missing. He'd disappeared from the family home. And this is when they find his body at the rented flat. As I said, it's in Gros de Roy, that's near Montpellier in the south of France. And it's actually a really beautiful seaside resort. It's on the Mediterranean coast. And obviously the suicide note accompanied him. Now, it's been confirmed by the state prosecutor that indeed the DNA sample taken from Verove after his death absolutely linked him to several of the crime scenes of La Grêle. So there is no doubt whatsoever that this man is entirely responsible for these horrific murders. He's been linked to 4 murders and 6 rapes, but officials said undoubtedly he's responsible for more. Now, 3 of the murders have been proven, and that's because they were confirmed by DNA analysis. We also have to understand that at the time, investigations of these crimes were not as they would be today. There will be a lot of chances that forensic evidence will have been misplaced, lost, it will have been eroded because of the passage of time. And so that means that it might not always be possible to pin crimes on him that he carried out, but it's highly doubtful that he stopped offending as he suggested he stopped offending. He moved around. It's as simple as that. And also, let's think about his poor family. He had a family. He had a wife. He had 2 children. They described him as a really happy, active, friendly man who apparently seemed really content. His wife said that she absolutely, under no circumstances, had any awareness of what she put as her husband's dual personality. His daughter said, "My mother wasn't aware of anything. We've got nothing to say." I understand that. You know, it's not for them to apologise for anything this monster did. And during that 35 years where he says he paused the killing, he just got on with, I suppose, suburban life. He lived in the residential district of Jolens in Le Grand Mot in Hérault. He lived there for 35 years. And he lived in a very beautiful, large, white house. To all intents and purposes, he was a pillar of the community as far as some people are concerned. And he was living a quite a nice, middle-class life. Interestingly, during the 35-year-old police hunt, he actually went on a popular television game show. So in 2019, that's how recent this man was on television. Like I said, bold. Like I said, arrogant. Like I said, superior. Like I said, thought he got away with it. Simple as that. You don't go on TV when you've got victims out there who are living and breathing unless you have a confidence that is very, very unusual. Now, don't get me wrong, that narcissism can be a chink in somebody's armor. It can lead to a victim recognizing them, and that can be the house of cards falling. But it can also smell of a person who is so convinced of how they have disguised themselves, of their chameleon effect, that they can do anything, go anywhere, and that people simply won't believe that they have the capacity to kill. Even if he bumps into a victim, I believe that he thinks that time has passed, he's progressed as a human, he looks different, etc., and that he's essentially an anonymous killer walking amongst victims. So he goes on the French game show, Tout le monde veut prendre sa place, which is everyone wants to take their place. It's on State Channel France 2. Now, on TV, he basically speaks about his jobs in the police, which again is a little bit out there, isn't it? You know, you have living victims who are watching popular game shows. You got a guy on there who looks like the killer, has a pockmarked face, yes, his age, but he's also talking about being in the police. He's almost identifying himself. Is there a part of you listening to me that thinks he's probably enjoying it? He's probably like, yeah, I'm so ahead of the game. I'm so good at disguising myself. I can literally go on national TV. I can tell you that I was a police officer. You know, you can probably hear about who I am and what I've done in the press because I've been on TV, etc. And he's just doing it in the face of his victims. Is there something about his mindset and mentality that's just enjoying it? It's a thrill to dice with that situation of potentially being discovered. And at the same time, believing, no, I'm too good for anybody to notice. I've disguised myself so well, no one's going to realise. He also explained that he was a constable before he joined the Mounted Police. Then he'd been in the motorcycle brigade in the 1980s. And he actually said that he worked in Paris as a police officer and he, quote, kept walkers safe. Again, is he just so unbelievably arrogant that he's dangling truth in front of people without us knowing and seeing? Kept walkers safe, like that child at the edge of woodland that was discovered after being horribly raped, like that child that was abducted to a farmhouse and was horrifically tortured. Kept walkers safe? He's laughing at us. He's laughing at the victims. He's enjoying every single moment. He actually answered general knowledge questions. He laughed and he joked with the host. And it just shows you, doesn't it? He didn't try to hide from the police. He went publicly on TV. Now, after his identity was revealed, after it was confirmed that it was indeed Francois Verove, people around him were devastated. His neighbours were shocked. They couldn't believe it. They were literally lost for words at the revelation. They were saying that he was this guy who was a family man. He led a really quiet life. One neighbour told reporters, we used to chat over the wall separating our gardens. Francois was this sturdy bloke. He's very tall. He was helpful as anything. He would come round, often fix my wife's computer, get it sorted in just a few minutes. This story is just unbelievable. You can imagine, can't you, just how that community's vulnerability will have been shattered further because of the fact that they invited him into the home. Imagine knowing that you had a serial killer and a serial rapist in your home. You probably had kids there, your wife there, happily chatting with him, making a cup of tea, giving him a glass of wine. And all of a sudden you're like, oh my God, this man could have killed us. I don't know how you move past that in life, genuinely. I do a talk called The Serial Killer Next Door. It's all about whether you would know if there was a serial killer living next door. And clearly in this case, no, you wouldn't, because they are chameleons of the highest order. And locals to Verove actually said that one of the things that they hadn't known about him after hearing the description of the original killer was he always had a beard. So he understood that that beard was important because otherwise the pockmarks that were so notable in the press that could have been seen and could have led individuals to have identified him because of his skin condition. So he obviously had an awareness that it was essential to try at least to disguise himself to some degree. And he did that very, very effectively for 35 years. Like I said, just because this guy writes in his note that he hadn't gone ahead and killed or raped anybody else during that period of time, we don't believe that. We don't believe it because these individuals are notorious liars. He was also described by people as a really active man, a busy man. He'd organized neighborhood meals in 2018. This is a quote from one of the neighbors. There were all the people from the neighborhood there for a meal with neighbors. It was really friendly. There was nothing to alarm us. You would have had to be very perceptive. Of course, no one's going round to have a neighborhood meal with somebody thinking, oh, which one of you is a serial killer? Like, imagine if the world was like that. Could you imagine if you approached every single day like that? You know, just going to work and you're sitting there and you're in the office at a meeting and you're thinking, which one of you bastards is secretly killing people at home? That just isn't the way, is it? You know, you don't invite your friend round and then on the third glass of wine on an evening and you're just about to order a takeaway and you're like, I really have some misgivings about her this evening. She's just put pineapple on a pizza. That certainly pangs of some kind of serial killer vibe. It's not the way, by the way, I like pineapple on my pizza. I'm not trying to offend people who like pineapple. I actually think pineapple can add to most dishes, if I'm completely honest. People out there are probably just shaking their head at me going, no, don't put pineapple on pizza. But at the end of the day, horses for courses. I happen to also like sliced peaches in peanut butter sandwiches. Bit weird. But I'm not a serial killer is what I'm saying. We don't live our lives with that idea that we have to be scared of people. And sometimes that's our downfall. But it's also how we live without horrendous anxiety every single day of the week. So those neighbours, of course, they didn't think that the man who was kind and lovely and jovial and fun was also a child killer. A former colleague of him, this is where he held positions within the municipal council, said that he'd become involved in local politics because he'd retired from the police force, so he wanted to be front-facing, he liked being important. And the Prades-le-Lez former mayor, Jean-Marc Lusser, he expressed how he was really disturbed to find out who Verove really was. He said, there are things that are shocking. For example, he served on the Municipal Social Action Committee. He participated in discussions to find out if we were helping people, how we were helping them. It's very destabilizing. And colleagues from Montpellier police were devastated. They were absolutely stunned. He was really popular among the police department. A quote reads, he was an ordinary police officer. He was appreciated in his department for his professionalism, for his good humor, a man without fuss. That's in any case the image he gave us. I can tell you that learning today that he was the author of Crimes and Rapes is still causes astonishment in our ranks. I think of these colleagues who were close to him. It's very difficult for them. Yeah, not quite as difficult as it is for the victims and the victim's family, but I understand it is challenging to realise you hung out and had drinks with and had fun with a guy who literally tortured and murdered children. But like I said, that's not on those individuals who spent time with these people. Serial killers are very good at pretending to be like you or I. Even better at pretending to be like you or I because they are guarded. They act in a certain way to be presentable. Most of us don't do that. We don't feel need. So often they can seem to be the most upstanding members of our community because that's what they do day in, day out, they act. Now, sadly for the parents of 11-year-old Cecile, they died before her killer was unmasked. The family lawyer actually said it was painful to know that the criminal took secrets with him and they probably died younger than they should because of the stress that that bastard caused. Let's be honest, stress is one of the biggest causes of death. And you die of broken hearts and there is nothing more heartbreaking, nor will ever be more heartbreaking than losing your child. But to lose your child in such an utterly traumatic, torturous fashion, I do not know how you breathe a single second past that moment. I have the deepest respect for those who manage it. I do not feel I am one who could. And I pray that I never need to be. I don't want to discover that about myself either way. Understandably, the police are saying that Verove may well be responsible for more murders, and they're actually looking in currently to 9 homicides committed between 1983 and 1994. So the jury is still out. Like I said, serial killers stop killing. Sometimes forever, sometimes for decades, sometimes for years, sometimes for a range of different reasons, but they stop. But it doesn't mean they don't start again. And if there is one thing that I know about these prolific killers, it's that they are liars of the highest level. So whatever he scribbled in that suicide note, that is probably the most vanilla version of events that there could be. He changed his MO. He changed how he killed. That's what happens. They perfect it. And he didn't always kill. Sometimes he just raped. And he didn't stick with children. Sometimes they were adult. When there is a confusing victim profile, when there are different methods of killing, when there's a sophisticated individual carrying out the killings, unless you have the DNA profiles and the forensic evidence that can link that person to all of the crimes, many of those murders and rapes that so far have not been solved may never be connected with this man. I don't believe the killings I've covered and the rapes I've covered today are the only ones he's responsible for. I will always add in the description below if any new information comes to light, and we do indeed find him being linked to more and more people. What I will say is it's a very big shame that Verhoeven didn't have to stand in court and have his sentence read to him and the victim impact statements read to him and see his family's horror and shame. He deserved that. But I trust in a greater force to dole out the punishment that he deserves, and it will be the punishment of the highest level. I have no doubt. His victims, I believe, are in bliss and paradise. And he, well, he is in hell. Exactly where he belongs.
That's it for Bang to Rights today. Join me for the next episode. See you then. Be safe.